I have had many different views of the identity of Mystery Babylon over the years. For example, I used to believe it was Rome or the Vatican. I couldn't quite decide which one I thought it was, and I believe that, I think, first. Then I kind of moved into the allegorical view, that is to say, it was like the hub of all bad things that have ever existed, or the source of all occult evil and financial evil is sort of, I kind of viewed it. As much as I liked to take scripture at face value, that was one area where I tended to go a little allegorical. And it kind of bothered me just a little bit, because it did seem to offend the hermeneutic that I had kind of grown up in with Calvary Chapel, and that is that we take the Bible seriously and we take it at face value, and if it says one thing, it means it. And I was really, when I first heard this, I really rejected the idea, and I still am, but one of the reasons is because I was very pro-Israel. I've done a lot of evangelism and apologetics, and a lot of that apologetic work was, doing apologetics against anti-Semitic stuff. So I've got a lot of videos like debunking the Khazar idea and a lot of nonsense that's out there. So yes. I'm a big supporter of Israel. I'm just through and through. So that was one reason that I initially rejected the idea when I first heard it from a Moody Bible professor of hermeneutics named Charles Cooper. And so the thing was, though, is that so John sees this vision in Revelation 17, the very beginning. He describes it. There's a woman. She's sitting on the seven-headed, ten-horned beast, and the beast is sitting on these waters. And then the angel says, "Why are you wondering about that? I'll tell you what it is." And then the angel goes through the rest of the chapter telling him that it's a city. He says, what you're seeing is the great city that rules over the kings of the earth. And it goes on to say a ton of characteristics that are only applicable to a literal city. We see smoke burning. We see, it gets attacked and famine and fire and a lot of things. And from that point on, it's all city language. The angel, when it does its interpretation, does not fool around anymore.
And I got to tell you that I've struggled with this passage as well. And, I mean, where I stand currently is I think it's going to be the rebuilt city of Babylon, but, I'm open to persuasion. It's interesting. I recently had somebody on the show who was making the case that it's America. And, you listen to it and you're like, boy, those are some great arguments. This, America seems to fit in so many different ways. And yet there always seems to be some kind of a hitch. Where it doesn't fit, and of course I would suggest that even, a rebuilt Babylon in the land of Shinar, the land of Iraq, where that seems to fall down is that, it seems really hard that the merchants of the world and all the ships, that are bringing things to it. I mean, there's really no ports for Iraq. But, I mean, the challenge I would have with at least the way that Jerusalem is today is that it's not ruling over the kings of the world, but I've read about book. Yeah, I've read about half your book, and what I understand is that you're saying that it's not the Jerusalem today; it's the one in the tribulation. Is that right?
Oh yeah, such a good point. I'm not at all saying that Jerusalem is like currently controlling everything behind the scenes, like that kind of thing. Not at all. What we're seeing now is nothing like what Scripture is saying will happen. I'm talking about the time of the Antichrist. We all know when we talk about the end times, we know that a lot of things are happening in and around Jerusalem. We know, of course, the Antichrist sitting in the temple, so we've got a rebuilt temple. Clearly, the daily sacrifice has begun again. Because the daily sacrifice stops at the midpoint. You take things like the two witnesses who for 3.5 years are ostensibly prophesying to Jews that for the most part are not listening. And I would infer that because when they are killed, everybody seems quite happy about that. There are also different things that we can get, like in Daniel 11:36-45, we have the Antichrist on his rise to power, essentially destroying all the Muslim world, which, and at least all the enemies around Israel, which is a very strange concept, at least is the way that a lot of modern stuff is going in terms of Bible prophecy, because I think here's the problem that I think I've seen, not just in the reason why Mystery Babylon has previously been identified as the Catholic Church or Rome, and then today a lot of people identify it as, Islam or something. And I think that we have a tendency as Christians throughout history to identify these particular chapters as what we see in front of us. We're tempted to say, okay, what city is it right now that's ruling over the kings of the earth and doing all this persecution and killing? It was so easy, of course, for the reformers to see that as Rome. It was just like, well, there it is. You know, you've got this powerful, rich, you know, kind of blasphemous in their doctrine, if you want to take it a little bit that far and say that these are these people that are killing Christians. I mean, if you take it broadly, that's where, as you kind of mentioned, it does kind of break down in the details, because this is, as I've mentioned, there are 90 plus characteristics of this particular city. And if you go verse by verse and you really try to deal with those individual things and you don't want to allegorize it, then you do have to deal with 90 characteristics and they all have to fit. And Rome simply doesn't fit. I mean, Calvin, though he was, very much, you know, in calling, you know, Rome the Antichrist, he was also the guy who never did the one book of the Bible he never did a verse by verse on was the book of Revelation. Then, of course, in today we see the big boogeyman today is Islam, and I feel like a lot of people are playing fast and loose with the text in to squeeze Islam into being the Antichrist. Now, we can take it broadly and we can cherry pick verses and we can make it happen, but I don't think that in the details. I think that what we see, and this is the reason that it kind of hit me more and more as I began to dig into the details of it, because that's where this particular theory is best understood, is in the details. So, for example, there's specific things. Like, for example, Mystery Babylon is said to kill the prophets. And that particular thing is a pretty interesting claim, because we're told that by Christ, he says a few weird things about killing prophets. In Luke 13, he says, it cannot be, and I'll give you a little bit of the context. I'll just read it a little bit further. He says, the same day there came certain of the Pharisees saying, go unto him, get thee out and depart hence, for Herod will kill thee. And he said unto them, go ye and tell that fox, behold, I cast out devils and I do cures today and tomorrow and the third day, I shall be perfected. Nevertheless, I must walk today and tomorrow and the day following, for it cannot be that a prophet perish out of Jerusalem. So first of all, Jesus says, they're telling him to get out of town. Herod's going to kill him. He's like, no, I can't leave Jerusalem, because it cannot be that a prophet perish outside of Jerusalem. And then he says, oh, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, that which killeth the prophets and stonest them that are sent unto thee. He then goes on to declare that Jerusalem will be guilty for all the righteous blood of the earth. He says from Abel to Zechariah, who they killed, between the altar. We've got contextual biblical evidence that the prophets that were killed, you know, John the Baptist, and we go into the Old Testament, that we know biblically were killed, were in fact killed in Jerusalem, like Jesus mentioned Zechariah. But the others, like in Jewish history, it's a little bit, you know, even in Jewish history, like Isaiah being sawed in half and the rest of that, they're also in Jerusalem. I don't want to press the point too much, but it's something to say, hey, that's interesting, that the blood of the prophets is found in her. But in addition, there's these other things like,
I think that's okay. A strong point, actually, you know, because, you know, we start thinking about prophets. What other prophet has been killed outside of Jerusalem? And I can't think of any, you know, I mean, if we're going to talk about prophets, I mean, we're talking about the Old Testament prophets. Who else is there, right? So right. I think that is a pretty strong point, you know.
Some people, like the reformers, would try to say, right, well, in the New Testament, we're all, you know, kings and priests and this kind of thing. And I think that, you know, there's a valid point in that, but I really do think that there's explicit biblical evidence to say that when we're talking about prophets with a capital P, which I believe is what Jesus is referring to there by his mentioning of Zechariah. However, there's like a ton of stuff. I think it's important to kind of understand what the symbolism that John saw is, because I think that's where a lot of people miss this and are able to kind of look at it like something broad. So we know the seven-headed, ten-horned beast. So we've got this beast that, for all intents and purposes, we can just call Satan. In Revelation 12, he's a seven-headed, ten-horned beast. But specifically in when referring to the Antichrist in Revelation 13, we see that this seven-headed, ten-horned beast is there again. And the thing is that one of the heads has a mortal wound, which seems to be healed and all that. So it appears that these heads of this beast that this woman is riding, to put it another way, the angel tells us that the woman that is riding, if you will, the Antichrist, is a city. And the this is an interesting thing that happens. The Antichrist, this beast with this, particularly this one head, which is in view in terms of the Antichrist, he turns on her, this city, and eventually kills her. It describes it in Revelation 18 as he burns her with fire, you know, looted and famine and the rest of it. He kills the city, destroys the city via his kings, these 10 kings. Mm-hmm. So whatever the woman is, we have to recognize her as kind of a pawn in this game. She mm-hmm. says an interesting thing as she rides this beast. She says, "I am no widow. I have found my king," essentially. She's saying that I got a husband now. This thing that she's riding, she's proud of. She's saying that she's found her husband. This is the reason that she is a great harlot. There's only one. The city of Jerusalem is called a harlot over 100 times in the Old Testament, and some of those are very provocative verses that are applied directly to our verses here. The idea that he consistently used that she was a harlot was like an example is Ezekiel 16. "But thou did trust in thine own beauty and playedst the harlot because of thy renown, and pourest out thy fornication on everyone that passed by, his it was, and of thy garments that thou didst take, and deckest thyself in the high places with diverse colors, and playedst the harlot thereupon, and the like shall not come, neither shall it be so." I mean, this is just typical of what God says. And what's interesting is that the language is so consistent. So for example, she's the mother of harlots. That is to say that she, the city, has children, and those children are harlots. Now, what I'm saying to you is that
Hosea chapter 1 and 2 talk about that big time, you know.
Exactly. See, that's a consistent the Old Testament symbolism is that Jerusalem is like a mother, and that she has a sister. Her sister is Samaria, and they both have children, and their children are harlots. We have a mother of harlots, and then she has children that are harlots. So even that basic thing is something that's consistent. So when we're looking for, if we got to find a city, the angel tells us this is a city that's a harlot, but it doesn't stop there. It's amazing how consistent it is. One of the things that blew my mind is that in Revelation 18, there's two verses that are that speak of the items that the merchants bring to Mystery Babylon and gain a lot of wealth from it. And every commentary I think I've ever read, they just say, well, these are, you know, symbolic of, you know, wealth, and this is to show that Mystery Babylon will have a lot of wealth. We're not to take these things seriously. But if you do take them seriously and you do a word search, we were talking about the treasury of scripture knowledge, and this thing blew my mind when I took just one word and did a Bible study on each word that appears in those merchants brought. For the most part, all of those things are found in like one other chapter in the Bible that are described, well, two other chapters particularly. One of them is the chapter that describes the things that are needed for the daily sacrifices. In fact, there's a long string of things that are needed, very specific things. When it talks about cinnamon and incense and there's a string of things right there. That's the exact phrase of the things that are needed if the daily sacrifices to be instituted again. And so this kind of gets the idea. I could go on, but basically everything that that they're bringing is stuff that is needed if you're going to reinstitute the Jewish temple religious system. And this is the crux of the whole thing, is that it seems to me that what's being described here is that the Antichrist capitalizes on something that the Jews have always wanted. That is to say, the conquering Messiah motif. And keep in mind, this will in fact happen, of course. Jesus Christ will in fact rule with a rod of iron from Jerusalem, and Jerusalem will in fact be the capital city of the world, and it will rule over all the cities of the Gentiles, etc. But you have to understand, from a Jewish mindset, there is no, at least a current Jewish mindset that doesn't understand the scriptures that very well, is that there is no messianic candidate that can be accepted unless he makes Jerusalem the capital city of the world, period. That is the thing he must do to fulfill all the prophecies of the millennial period. There must be a worldwide pilgrimage system to Jerusalem to fulfill Isaiah 65, and we can go on. We can talk about Zechariah and following.
Well, you know what's interesting?
Is that,
go ahead. I just want to say what's interesting is, you know, you're made reference to this idea of the Muslim Antichrist. But having read Joel Richardson's book, he does make the point there that the Mahdi is going to set up his kingdom in Jerusalem. You know, so I'm not saying that, you know, that the guy's going to be a Muslim, but still, even, you know, it seems like all roads do point back to Jerusalem. So that's really fascinating.
Right. And I've read Richardson's book too. And I would say that whatever, however it works, it does seem that there is an acceptance of, and Jesus makes an interesting reference to this in terms of the acceptance of the Antichrist. He says, I have come in my Father's name and you do not receive me. If another comes in his own name, him you will receive. There is this idea that there's going to be a reception of him. And essentially that's what Antichrist means. It's an anti-Messiah. And if you think about a possible theology that he will present, it's actually quite good. I'm already sort of thinking of a good debunkumentary for this theology. But let me first say this, that everything I'm presenting here, I want to present and be clear that I don't consider myself too dogmatic about it. I wanted to put it out there as a potential scenario that we could kind of tuck away in our hearts if, in fact, we see the scenario come up. But it's important that we – and I commend you for even considering a view that I know that, you know, that you're skeptical of, and I know a lot of the people in your audience are skeptical about. But I want to say what a rare thing that is, that a person would have something on their show that they are skeptical about, but they're willing to hear it out. There is a lack of that these days, and I think that you should be commended for that. Okay. But anyway, I forgot. I lost my train of thought where I was going.
Yeah.
So
I'm open, by the way. I mean, I think you're making a great case for it, and I can definitely see that. I think what people tend to guard against is this idea that it's somehow anti-Semitic, but it's not. I mean, you know, if you want to start looking for sort of anti-Semitic things in the Bible, God would probably be the biggest candidate of anti-Semitic statements. But, of course, he's incredibly pro-Semitic. But he's the one who says to Jerusalem, I'm going to divorce you, but then I'll remarry you. I mean, it's the tale of the two cities, really. You know, it's the tale of the two cities. You have this mystery Babylon, who is this whore on the one hand. You know, she's not been faithful. She's not been a pure, spotless bride. But then you have the new Jerusalem coming down from heaven, adorned as a bride, which the angel says, this is the wife of the Lamb. This is the bride of Jesus, you know. So, I mean, I think when you see the juxtaposition of these two cities, it really becomes very powerful.
Right, and it's certainly not anti-Semitic. It's like reading, you know, when you read in the Old Testament, as you mentioned, these things that talk about Jerusalem or Israel falling short, that's not an anti-Semitic activity. And this whole thing is ultimately a great story of redemption, and it mirrors our redemption in a way, that we also played the harlot and went after other gods. But God is faithful, and that's really the story of this particular thing. When Jerusalem is judged, it is judged, but the faithful remnant is taken out of that. When the Mount of Olives, Revelation 16 describes that Jerusalem is split into three sections during this great earthquake, the greatest earthquake of all time. And during that time, the Mount of Olives will be split. And if you read in the Old Testament about that in Zechariah, it seems that what's happening is that he's getting the faithful remnant out before he judges those that refuse to repent. And it seems that a full one-third of national Israel will be saved, in addition to those 144,000, but that's another story. So it's a story of redemption, but and so it's certainly not anti-Semitic. It's definitely not my intention to do that. In fact, as I've said, and I'll say again, I am very, very pro-Israel and always will be.
Yes, and I just want to underscore that for you, because I understand where you're coming from, and you know, this is. And I just hope people will understand that, you know, that this is not a slam against Israel. This is just saying, what does the scripture say? You know, in the end, Israel wins. Israel becomes the head and no longer the tail. We're just trying to understand, you know, where this is actually coming from. So, yeah, go on. I find it fascinating.
Yeah, well, there, you know, some of the things that I found interesting was like the way that she was dressed, for instance, are words that are always used in not just Ezekiel 16, but we have all these different places, like this idea of fine twisted linen and of blue, purple, and scarlet. This is the exact phrase, this linen, purple, and scarlet, that is used to dress the high priest. And I would just take that, and it's also used as to make a lot of the implements in this particular chapter, and that's describing the curtains and things that are building the temple. But she's dressed in such a way, using this very provocative language, the exact same words in the Hebrew. Of course, this is in the Greek, but the exact same string of words that are used. It would be one thing if it didn't add certain other things. For example, she has a name written on her forehead. It's Mystery Babylon, Mother of Harlots. But there's also a name written on the high priest's forehead, and that is Holiness to the Lord. He's got a golden band that has her name written on his forehead. What's essentially the symbolism here, I believe, is that she is, in her writing the Antichrist, is essentially fiercely promoting him to the rest of the world. What's happening is she's being kind of like an unholy high priest, which is exactly what's talked about in Ezekiel 16. He talks about how he decked her, and when Israel was in her youth, he decked her with gold and silver, and she was beautiful, and she prospered in that kingdom. But then you trusted in your beauty, and you played the harlot because of your renown, and you poured us out your fornications on everyone that passed by. So he says, you'd used all this beauty that I gave you to play the harlot. But anyway, the point is that what's essentially happening is this interesting verse that I love in the King James. It says that let's see if I can find it. It says that she with the inhabitants of the earth are made drunk. But it's interesting what they're made drunk with. The nations of have drunk of the wine of the wrath of her fornication. So another translations say the fierceness or the passion of her fornication. That's actually what's in the cup. It's not blood or anything. It's the product of her doing this great and terrible abomination. These people that should know their God are worshiping Satan, worshiping the Antichrist, and then Satan by proxy. So what is happening here is that her fornication is so wrathful or so passionate that it draws the nations, it makes the nations drunk. What I'm describing here is something that basically, I can't tell you, Doug, is something that I see anywhere in the geopolitical landscape. That is to say that the nations of the world, which are totally anti-Semitic, are going to all of a sudden be drawn into the Jewish religion because of the fierceness of her fornication. In other words, she is so passionate that she has found her Messiah that the rest of the world starts to take notice. Has she found her Messiah? What is this guy? What's he doing? But this is where I think a lot of the things that the false prophet does start to make sense. So first of all, the false prophet is calling down fire from heaven to presumably consume the sacrifices, which I would assume that's what he did, which was to use in the Old Testament to validate in that case Elijah as a true prophet. But in this case, I think that these daily sacrifices perhaps are consumed. I don't know if it's a particular sacrifice or continual fire from heaven, but I think the false prophet really is a false prophet. And because of course, to convince the Jews that you've got the Messiah, you've got to have Elijah, right? Mm-hmm. There is no Messiah without Elijah. And I think that's what the function of the false prophet is to serve as this precursor for their false Messiah. And he does these things that validate him. And I think that's where the world starts to pay attention. Okay, now there's fire coming down from heaven. And you've got to imagine if there's a new sacrificial system going on, that probably means that the Ark of the Covenant has been found. Can you imagine what would happen to the world right now? The world that even – most of the world says that Solomon's temple didn't even exist, let alone David's. That's the same temple, but the second temple didn't exist. Or not the second temple, but – that Solomon's kingdom wasn't a real kingdom is what I'm trying to say. And so if you find the Ark of the Covenant, it's a great validation of really Yahweh. And so you could have, and I think this is the thing that kind of tipped me to this, is that even though it doesn't make sense, I mean, I much prefer all the other theories. I've promoted a lot of theories about the Antichrist in my time because they made a lot of sense to me in my logic about what the world should do in particular given situations. But if you think that Satan, and I know from my ministry to the New Age, that Satan loves a good truth, and some of his best cults have a very good kernel of truth. That's kind of how he operates. And so what better of a situation to be able to point to a truth, that is to say Jesus Christ will one day rule from Jerusalem, and that it will be the capital city of the world, and that Messiah is coming back, and that all these prophecies are supposed to happen. That's a really good base from which to draw on if you're going for a big false doctrine. So he's got a lot of truth to work. And think about this. He can point to scriptures and say, look, Jesus, this guy that you think is the Messiah, he said he was going to, you think he's a Messiah, but look at all these scriptures he didn't do. I mean, you know, even the apostles were looking at him as he, you know, right before he ascended into heaven and said, you know, now is the time, Lord, that you're going to, you know, defeat the Romans and make us the capital city and the rest of the things that are supposed to happen. And Jesus said, it's not for you to know the times. Don't worry about it and whatever. But the point is that the Antichrist will have something to say. He's going to say, did he deliver you from your enemies? Did he do any of the things that I did? And that's what makes Daniel 11 so powerful, is that you've got this weird thing of the Antichrist completely obliterating the enemies of Israel. And then the last thing that you hear is that he sets up his royal tents between the waters and the holy mountain. And then it says, now Michael shall stand up and there will be a time that it will be unlike any other time. It talks about what we commonly refer to as the great tribulation at that midpoint, exactly where you would expect it to be. So we've got this. So I think that he has a lot – this. In other words, there are a ton of wars of Antichrist before Antichrist is validated. And Daniel 11 is giving us exactly the play-by-play of those wars. And this is what is scary to me about the idea that it's common nowadays that we're going to have a Muslim Antichrist. Because consider this scenario. What if – and everybody in the news media, we're all scared of Muslims and da-da-da-da-da. Everybody's scared of Muslims. And that may be rightly so. That's really not what I'm trying to say here. I'm trying to say that what if you did have a guy that defeated all of the terrorism in the world and protected Israel? What if Israel was under serious threat at this time too? You know, they really were getting attacked and whatever, and you've got a guy that completely miraculously delivers them. Who can make war with the beast after all? You know, that's one of the reasons that everybody worships him. Who can make war with the beast? You know, he is the guy who is not able to be made war with. So when I see the abomination of desolation, I see things that perhaps based on the fact that Jesus tells people in Jerusalem to flee when they see the abomination of desolation. And he tells them that because of a persecution that begins. He says at that time, a persecution that will happen will be unlike any other time and that has ever happened or will ever happen. In order for that to happen, there has to be a bunch of people who really think that him sitting in a temple and declaring himself to be God is not that much of an abomination, if you catch my drift. They're going to be on board. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the same kind of – if you've got enough people to essentially make Jerusalem the epicenter of the greatest persecution of all time, then you have a lot of people that are on board with the Antichrist's message.
Well, you know, I start thinking about Babylon. I mean, you know, God really is irate against Babylon because they are the ones that introduced, you know, all of the false religions. You know, I've gone back to the idea of it being Bab El, which is the gate of the god or gods. And, you know, it was a place where Nimrod, he set it up. Of course, Nimrod means let's rebel. You know, so, I mean, I think you're offering a lot of interesting stuff. It's compelling. But somehow, you know, it's going to take me some while to just think about all these things, you know, because – you know, it is obviously a major paradigm shift, and you may be right.